that's a false impression, especially if you go down in the winter time. You can see that the region right around the Dead Sea region, or the Dead Sea, is very fertile. In fact, if you look at some of the agricultural statistics, modern agricultural statistics in Jordan, you find that the Jordan Valley itself, to the north of the Dead Sea, is the most fertile, productive land in Jordan. The Dead Sea Basin itself is the next productive, and then when you get up onto the plateau, and further east you move, the least productive land you find. But at least today, we know that in terms of modern agriculture, the Dead Sea Basin is very fertile, very productive, although during the months of June, July, and August, there is somewhat of a hiatus, although even then you do have quite a few melons, cucumbers, squash, things like that, that continue to grow even during the hot summer months. We also know that in ancient times, the Dead Sea Basin was very fertile and very productive. The oldest material that we have comes from Jericho. And on the basis of the botanical material that's been uncovered in Jericho, found during the 1950 excavations of Kathleen Kenyon, Jericho has been described as the earliest, or one of the earliest, agricultural villages in this part of the world, in the Levant. Actually, the evidence from Jericho in the early period, so-called pre-pottery Neolithic age, which starts around, or at least the plant remains in this period, date to around 7,000 BC. The plant remains are fairly scant. In fact, all they found are two grains of emmer wheat and six grains of so-called two-row barley and a very few fig pips, seeds from figs. Once you get to around 6,500 BC, you find at least at Jericho that the agriculture seems to have diversified. You find a lot more plants in terms of the quantity and also more diversity. You start finding lentils and chickpeas and things like that as well. One of the problems with the material from Jericho is that there was no concerted effort in the 50s to recover botanical remains. Therefore, and no flotation, as we were discussing last time. Therefore, all of the material that they found at Jericho was simply detected visually, which means we can almost be positive that most of the botanical material in those excavations were overlooked. In the later period, Tel Gasul is another important chalcolithic site dating from around 4,500 BC to 3,500 BC. There again, there are plant remains, including barley, wheat, and date are the most common ones, and a few of the legumes like pea, bean, and chickpea. Again, flotation was not used, so there are very few plant remains from Tel Gasul, although we know for certain that at least these crops were being grown at that period. In the 1960s, quite a few plants were found in caves along the western side of the Dead Sea. And those have been reported. The problem with the reports is that the excavations took place so rapidly, these caves, most of them were cleared out within 1 or 2 days. And they contained both chalcolithic pottery and Roman pottery, and that was the basis for dating the contents. And they were dug so quickly and evidently so carelessly that the strata were mixed up. So in the reports you'll see pictures of plants with the caption underneath, chalcolithic and Roman plants, which is separated by about 4,000 years. So you don't know if this particular pomegranate dates from the chalcolithic period or from the Roman period. That again is, has been, at least up until this time, fairly typical that things like pottery are dug fairly stratigraphically. Not much attention has been paid to the stratigraphy of plants. I would like at this point, though, to make one was talking about last time about archaeologists concentrating up to this point on pottery and architecture. I certainly didn't want to create the impression that pottery and architecture are not important. I guess I'm just a little jealous that plants have not received the attention that these other things have. So I certainly wouldn't say that pottery and architectural studies have been overemphasized, just the study of ancient plant remains have been underemphasized. So we know from these caves, from Tel Gassul and Jericho, that the region around the Dead Sea was a center of agricultural activity going back to the beginning of settled life in the Neolithic period. But from those remains, we really don't have a very clear idea of how the agricultural system functioned. We know some of the plants that were grown, but we don't really have good evidence for whether or not irrigation was practiced, whether or not agricultural commodities were exchanged between communities, whether crops were rotated, and so forth. And those are some of the questions that we were interested in trying to solve or find more information about on the Bab el-Draa and Numera excavations. These are two sites which date to the early Bronze period between 3000 and 2000 BC. Now, I realize that some of you have actually visited the site, but for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, I'd like to rush through a few slides showing the sites, giving a little indication of what's there, and then we will be talking about what we found in terms of the ancient plant remains. Okay, this is a map which I think will be pretty familiar to everybody, the Dead Sea right in here. And the area that we're talking about here, of course, is Jericho on this side, Tel Gassul, the Chalcolithic site is up here, all along this shoreline. You have very steep mountains and escarpments, so there is no agricultural land, or at least not down here beyond Zephaniah. The so-called southern bore is the area that we'll be concentrating on, and that is from the Lizan, right in here, where you have the modern village of Mazra, which means farm, and on down to the southern basin. This is where Safi is located in the modern Potash. The caves I mentioned that have produced some plant remains, which some of which probably dates from the Chalcolithic period, from some along the western shore here. Okay, this is a picture that we saw last time, a satellite photograph of the Dead Sea region. The reason I threw it in again is just again to point out that it's infrared photography, and your oases or areas of vegetation show up as red patches. So this is Jericho here, Hasul here, the Wadi Mujib, and the Wadi Karak, with the site that we'll be looking at first, Bab el-Draa, located right where the Wadi Karak bends and empties into the Dead Sea, and the other site, Numera, located right down here on this alluvial fan. For those of you who have been down there, one landmark which is very close to the ancient site of Numera is the potash camp that was set up, I believe, in 1977. This was taken, boy, I'd have to look to check the exact year, I think around 73. You can see the dike that's in the middle and some of the potash works on the other side, but as you can see, the potash project here had not started at that time. If you see more recent pictures of the Dead Sea, you'll see this whole thing being dried up, or at least it was on. You can walk across it if you don't care about landmines. and they're pumping water over that into the southern basin now.
And the vegetation in the north is only covers the top part.
Right. Yeah, it would be interesting. I would imagine if you would get, and we hope to do this very soon, get some more recent satellite photographs, you'd find, because of the East Gore Canal project, that these red patches extend much further down and are much larger than the earlier part of this decade. These are the two sites that we're going to be looking at, Baba Dra and Mara. Very quickly to tell you about the discovery of the sites. Baba Dra was found in 1924. It was forgotten about, attracted very little attention until the 1960s, when a lot of early Bronze Age pottery started showing up in Jerusalem in the antiquities market. A fellow by the name of Paul Lapp, along with others, was able to trace that pottery back to Baba Dra, and they began excavations there in 1965, two seasons, and then one in 1967. They found a massive cemetery at Baba Dra. As far as we know, it's the largest cemetery in the region here. Paul Lapp died in 1970. He had planned to continue working. Following his death, two of his students, Tom Schaub and Walt Drass, picked up the work. And in 1973, they came back to the Southern Boer, not only to look at Baba Dra again, but to do a survey. An archaeological survey to try to identify possible other early bronze sites in the region. And in fact, they were able to come up with one here called Mera, about 13 kilometers south of Baba Dra. Another one, Safi. Actually, they didn't find an early bronze city at Safi, but they found an early bronze cemetery and concluded if people were dying there, they were probably living there as well. The city, in fact, may have been washed away by the Waipasa that comes up. Another early Bronze Age site at Fefe and one here at Tanazir. I should also take this opportunity to mention the Wadi Esal is one between Baba Dra and Mara, and our NEH fellow Linda Jacobs is going to be going down to the Wadi Esal in just a very few days, starting a survey trying to identify all archaeological sites along the Wadi, but her primary interest is early Bronze Age sites or small settlements in the outlying region. Is that correct? There's also a very nice Roman road that comes from the plateau down into the Gore, and of course that's one of the reasons that Linda's picked this particular wadi, because it does seem to be an important ancient access route from the plateau to the Gore. One other thing we know, or at least we're pretty sure of, that in ancient times there was a road going from near Baba Dra right across the Lizan, and that there was a ford connecting the Lizan to the other side. In fact, that may be one of the reasons that Baba Dra was located where it was at the crossroads and trade routes. Okay, this is an aerial view of the Baba Dra site, which is right down in here. The Lizan, again, if you see this today, you'll see that this bay at Masra has dried up to about this point, and the Lizan extends much further out now. As you can see from this shot taken in June of 1977, Baba Dra, this area, does not appear to be a garden spot, especially in the summer. But in the winter, all of this land right along here is cultivated, most of this area right here in wheat. Okay, an aerial view of the Baba Dra Cemetery, which is right in here, and the city site, it's hard to pick out, but is right up in here. This big erosional cut, as we'll see, is right in the center of the city. This is what first attracted attention to Baba Dra. You can see these little holes that look like craters. Those are all shaft tombs, which are burials which date the beginning of the cemetery to around 3,200 BC. Shaft tombs are used throughout the occupation of Baba Dra for about 1,000 years, and from 3,200 to about 2,100. As we'll see, there are different phases. First shaft tombs, then little round charnel houses, then big square charnel houses. We'll define those terms in a minute. This is what a typical shaft tomb of Baba Dra looks like. It's a shaft that's dug down anywhere from 1.5 meters to 3 meters deep. And then there are little entrances to chambers that go off of the shaft. These, of course, had a blocking stone in them originally. And as soon as all of the chambers were filled up, the ancients refilled the shaft, so that today they're very hard to identify. You have to actually do some trenching before you can identify where a shaft is. This is a view inside a fairly typical chamber at Baba Draw. You can see pops are usually laid around the right side. Usually you have disarticulated variables, which means the bones were separated. This is one of the few cases in which we have an articulated burial where the deceased was laid in one piece. This white material that you can see is simply the roof collapse. This particular tomb was dug by the Smithsonian Institution in 1977, and since that time they've reconstructed the tomb, what they think it looked like originally, at the Smithsonian. So if you go there, you can see this particular tomb, and you can go down to the Baba Draw site and still see the shaft.
Is that the salt that was made?
Yeah, that's another thing. There is very often pottery, well, always pottery in the chambers. Very often you have a large basalt bowl, sometimes two of them in the chambers.
David, has the Smithsonian done a little exhibit of Baba Draw in Washington? Or is just this tomb is all there?
Well, they actually have two tombs there, and yeah, those have been on display since 1978, I think.
Are there other things as well, or just the tombs?
Just the tombs. They do have a little bit of plant material, too, if I remember correctly. I think they have some barley and a few other things in display next to this. Also, they do have a short skeleton on the Baba Draw excavation.
Is there any explanation why the bones
were
in disarray rather than
There is, and as we go along, we'll talk about that. Again, this guy is, you know, in pretty good shape, really. There's some disorder. But as you'll see in a minute, most people aren't that well articulated. Of course, there's going to be some collapse, like in this gal was also put in one piece, and the roof collapsed, and of course that spread the bones to a certain extent. This is another example of an articulated skeleton. As Scott will be talking about next time, the osteologist is able to determine by study of the femur and other bones whether it was male, female, the age, and so forth. This is supposedly a young woman who had a small infant right down in here. Infants very often aren't very well preserved. And another one, this was about 6.5 months old, and another baby about a year and a half. You see a little fertility figure in here. That's also very typical, atypical grave offering in Baba Draw. We'll discuss later what possible implications of that is, putting a fertility figure in the dead. This is more typical than Baba Draw. Usually you find pottery here, a bone pile in the middle where you have finger bones and toe bones, things like that. And then the long bones of your arms and legs stacked parallel on top and skulls around the left side. Obviously, these people were not in one piece when they were placed in the tomb. There are a number of different explanations. The one which enjoys most widespread acceptance is that these people were nomads, and they were traveling through the desert 9 months out of the year, and if Grandpa kicked the bucket in the middle of the desert, rather than cart the body around for 9 months, you would bury him, come back in 5 or 6 months, dig up the remaining bones, and take it back to Baba Draw, where the cultic burial place was. There are some problems with this theory. One of them is that the skulls are generally well preserved, for as you would think, if the bones, skull bones, are being carted across the desert on the back of a camel in a burlap bag or whatever, that it would have been jostled around. So that's one possible explanation, but there are others that we can talk about perhaps afterwards.
Well, also did secondary burials, and they were nomads.
Right, and there are modern examples of so-called primitive societies, you know, the villagers do practice secondary burial.
Maybe.
Yeah, there's no indication from any of the bones that they were eating one another. There are no butcher marks on the bones. No indication that the meat was stripped off with a knife or other sharp object or roasted off, which is caused some people to think, to theorize that the flesh was boiled off the bones. Another typical example of a bone pile with little fertility figurines around, a close-up of the fertility figurines. You can see they're very crude mud made out of unbaked clay. The cemetery is so intensively used that you very often find honeycombing like this, where one chamber has cut into another chamber. Very often you'll find a temporary patch that was put up. In this case, that patch has fallen off. Linda and I were down at the cemetery about 4 years ago and walked, crawled into one of the chambers that had been rubbed out by locals, and found that we were able to go from one chamber to another, actually entered five different chambers because of this honeycombing phenomenon. This is a round charnel house. After, right around the time of the beginning of the Babi Grah city, around 2800 BC, you find, although shaft tombs are still being used, charnel houses begin to be used, little round mud brick structures. And generally, you would have a few more individuals, maybe up to 15 or 20 individuals buried in these. The next phase, when you're in fully urban period, are these big square charnel houses. You can get some idea of the scale with the people standing here. This charnel house produced approximately 250 individuals and almost 900 whole pots. We have good evidence that they were two stories high, made out of mud brick, with wood beams extending across them and using reeds as roofing.
I don't understand the meaning of charnel house. Does it have any meaning other than that there were lots of bodies in it?
Yeah, I think that's...
That's it?
Lapp was the one who really coined the phrase, or at least applied it to Babi Grah.
Doesn't mean that they were burned or anything?
Not really, although there are about half of the charnel houses do show signs of burning. It's a question of whether that was intentional at the time of burial or whether that happened later. If you accept the theory of the invasion of Babi Grah, then it could be that those invaders burned down the funeral buildings for some reason.
Are the bones in there burned?
Again, quite a number of them are, but you have cases of some that are and some that aren't.
After the war,
possibly, but as far as I know so far, there's not a lot of evidence from the bodies in here that they died violent deaths. You know, if you have a lot of victims of war, you expect to find a few heads caved in and bones broken, things like that. That you don't find so much. Okay, this is one of the biggest charnel houses. It was excavated in 1979. Another view of it. As you can see, it has a partition down here and an entrance in the front. Some of the pottery that comes out of the charnel houses. We're going to have to really rush through this because, after all, I do want to get to the plant. This is an example of a bronze dagger that was found. As you can still see the rivets that held on the wooden handle. Some examples of some of the botanical material or organic material that comes from the charnel house, very thickly woven piece with some fragments of linen, probably made from local flax. Also a piece of roofing, or perhaps matting made out of reeds, very similar to the ones that still grow there today and are still used in the roofing by the villagers of Maja, a little bit called. All of this material dates to about 2500 BC. And in 79, for the first time, we found gold beads, which is some of the earliest gold found here in Georgia. And a little gold pendant. Okay, very quickly, this is what the city of Babadra itself looks like. You can see big erosional cuts, which have occurred since the abandonment of the site. What it looks like on the inside, as you can see, it's not easily identified as an ancient site. But these people here are walking down from the high area where we found the tower. You can trace part of the wall. Here it's very well preserved. Right over here, there's a break. The army was occupying the site in 67. And then the wall continues to extend around towards us. This is another shot of the interior of the site. This is that defense tower. This area over here seems to have been one of the main areas of residential occupation, and the big erosional cut that goes through the center of the site. It's another aerial view showing the city wall. That's where that tower was, and the big erosional cuts. And this is the Wadi Karak in the foreground. It's the picture of part of the defense wall that was excavated in 77 and 79. A view of the typical house of Babadra, as you can see. In their houses, they didn't use big stone architecture, but they're almost all made out of mud brick, a little door socket, southern city. This is a view from that defense tower towards the Wadi Karak. One of the reasons this is a particularly interesting shot is that, according to our geologists, towards the end of the early Bronze Age, there appears to have been a lot of earthquake activity in this region. He believes that in the early Bronze Age, when Babadra was occupied, the Wadi Karak probably came down to a very gentle slope, came straight across here. You can see kind of a natural saddle here. But because of earthquake activity, the floor of the Wadi Karak dropped rather abruptly, and that drop in elevation caused the acceleration of erosion to the sides here, and is one of the reasons that there's so much erosion that Babadra has had itself. After Babadra was abandoned, sometime around, say, roughly 2300 BC, maybe 2350, we do find some continued occupation on the outside of the city, this small little house foundations and parts and so forth, but not very deep occupation. To the south, this is the site of Numera, a little tower right up here. The site itself is along this plateau, and this is the seat of the Wadi Numera. An aerial view of the site of Numera. That's the tower I was talking about. You can see the main area of excavation and part of the defense wall. Up in the corner, you can see that temporary potash site, which now is the Wimpy. And as we mentioned last time, we have evidence that Numera experienced a very sudden destruction. One of the pieces of evidence we have for that are old pots like this, which were left in place. You remember last time we also looked at some examples of both barley and whole grapes that were found at the Babadra site. Material like that helps us actually date the time of the destruction, or at least we know that grapes in the Jordan Valley would have been ripening in the summer, certainly no later than September, probably July or August. So we can be fairly certain that the site was destroyed sometime in July or August, although we don't know the actual year of the destruction. Okay, that's all for that. That should give you, I think, some idea of what the area looks like and some of the questions we're dealing with. One of the big questions has always been, who were the inhabitants of Babadra? We know that the cemetery was used for approximately 200 to 300 years before the city itself was occupied, and that the cemetery then continued to be used for a couple hundred years after the city was destroyed or abandoned, which raises the question, were the people who were living and dying in the area from 3200 BC to 2800 BC, was it their descendants that actually founded the town of Babadra, or was it invaders, a common very popular view is that it was invaders from the north who came down and actually established urban culture in the Southern Gore, and that it was invaders then that came at the end of AD 3, around 2300 BC, and destroyed those people. Believe it or not, the plant material can give us at least some clues to some of the answers, or some of the questions, concerning the origins of these people and whether or not there was continuity at the site. I've got here a list of the main crops that we found at Baba Draw, and I'll just go through those and make a few comments on what this material is telling us besides the basic plant assembly.
I think I need to turn this